My guests today are film directors Andy Brown and Brian Lidstrom. Now, Andy Brown is an actor and screenwriter from New York City, and his acting credits include The Day Trippers and the MTV series Austin Stories. He also co-wrote, co-directed, and co-starred in the independent feature Pop Life. But as a writer-director, Andy co-created the series The Horrible, Terrible Misadventures of David Atkins, which won an award at the New York Television Festival. He has also worked in series development for Marshall Brickman and Castle Rock Entertainment, and he is currently working on a documentary about the music scene in New Orleans. And we have Brian Lidstrom, whose award-winning films explore the inner resources of marginalized people. His 2019 New York Times op doc, We Are Forbidden, produced with his wife Cheryl Strayed, is a film empowering teen girls in Nepal to share their experiences of menstrual stigma. Brian also did The Mothering Inside, which follows incarcerated moms and their children, which was instrumental in the efficacy movement, which made Oregon the first state to pass a Bill of Rights for the children of incarcerated parents. Now, his film, Alien Boy, The Life of Life and Death of James Chassé, is an intense examination of police brutality in the death of a nonviolent man and experiencing mental illness. But both Andy and Brian are here to talk about a brand new, incredible music film documentary, The Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Seal. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome film directors Andy Brown and Brian Lidstrom to the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Ward.
Hi. Thanks, Ward.
Well, I have to ask right off the bat, who is Judy Seal?
Well, Judy was the first artist signed to David Geffen's Asylum Records, which included her label mates, Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Browne, Crosby, Stills & Nash, Linda Ronstadt. And she was born in L.A. She moved to Oakland as a young girl, then back to L.A., where she spent most of the rest of her life. She made two beautiful records for Asylum, and then sadly died of a overdose in 1979.
So why did you want to tell her story?
Well, I think it was the main thing, of course, was just the majesty of her music. You know, we were both blown away by it, and we thought, how is it that we have never heard of her? We wanted to make sure that other people found their way to her incredible music, but I think we're equally drawn to her life story, which was completely a surprise, especially given the kind of ethereal, spiritual nature of her music. You know, when you find out some of the kind of harder facts of her life, at the first glance, it seems incongruous. But the more we got into her story and the more we understood about who she was, it sort of all made sense.
Yeah, her backstory and her music. Wow. Part of it, well, I guess you could call it synergy, but, you know, her life also dictated her songwriting. How would you describe her style of music?
Well, she really differed from her label mates, who are more in that Laurel Canyon, I guess you'd call it folk rock tradition. And her influences were more classical, gospel. She said her main influences were Bach, Pythagoras, and Ray Charles. Her grandmother was from Texas, and she learned all those, you know, Chill Wills, Texas folk songs from an early age. So that's in there as well. I think she had perfect pitch, so she was gifted with that. And I guess, you know, she combined a lot of that childhood trauma she went through influenced her lyrics, but she had the musical chops to pull off the songwriting that she was attempting to do.
Yeah, her songwriting, wow. I think you put the perfect word in the title for this documentary, genius. She wrote like no one else. She thought like no one else. She felt like no one else. And I found her talent beyond anything I had ever seen. Her musical knowledge, her songwriting ability became musical art that was actually ahead of our time in the early 1970s. Did her lyrics amaze you?
Absolutely. Everything about her amazed us. You know, she just was always a kind of constant source of wonder, both in her personal life and in her art. And it was so rewarding for us these last, 9, 10 years to be really kind of living with her, if you will. You know, I mean, she was a big part of our lives and continues to be.
Well, were you surprised that in the research that you did on Judy, on how many trails it led you down to so many people that knew who she was, but even getting down and deep into her story, even down to her childhood?
We were lucky because some of that work was done before we started the film. She made an album with her friends that was released posthumously in 2006 called Dreams Come True. And there was a booklet that accompanied that that had interviews with a lot of her old friends and family. And that was sort of our blueprint for how to proceed. So we did interviews based on who we discovered in that booklet. That helped. But as we went along, we started seeing, because she's arguably more well-known now than she was in her lifetime. So there are many musicians now alive because you can discover new music more easily now because of streaming that have been turned on to her. So that was sort of not clear to us at the beginning, but became more apparent as we went along that there were lots of people who, contemporary people who are influenced by her. And some of them are in our film, like Adrienne Lenker and Natalie Mehring and Robin Pecknold of Fleet Foxes. So that became a big part of it.
Yeah, I even noticed, you know, Graham Nash is in the film, and he stated that Judy knew where she wanted to go in her career. And I did love Judy's passion and her vision and her focus of being the best in the world. And that is something that I could relate to. But Graham mentioned that even though she knew where she wanted to go, it was her dark side that didn't allow her to bloom and prosper. What was her dark side?
Childhood trauma. You know, she was sexually abused by her stepfather. She lost her biological father at a very young age. He was incredibly dear to her. And then she had a probably genetic and because of the sexual abuse, biological predisposition to addiction. And, you know, she bravely, you know, tried to cope with that as best she could. And this was at a time before recovery was in the vernacular or the phrase childhood trauma even existed. As Andy said, she's kind of like a poster child for PTSD, you know, and it's really kind of interesting to look at her life and see just the strong will to survive that she had. You know, she surrounded herself with a kind of found family of friends who were, you know, devoted to her as she was to them. And, you know, part of our motivation in making the film was to dispel the kind of Wikipedia version of Judy that she was just a doom and gloom, you know, tragic artist. All her friends, you know, told us that, you know, she was the light. She would light up any room she came in. She was the life of the party. She knew all their birthdays. She was the one who always had people over for Thanksgiving. You know, she was a loving person. And we really wanted to give her a kind of full treatment and, you know, kind of restore, frankly, some of the humanity to her that maybe had been kind of, you know, taken away in things like the Wikipedia descriptions of her.
Both of you did a brilliant and stellar job with this film and telling her story. It is extremely complete. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a film documentary. If you love music, this is the one to see.
Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. One of the things that I noticed about her story, and I love the way that you brought it forth in the documentary, but because when I watch things, there's always an emotional side. Many of those in the music industry were highly impressed with Judy's musical prowess. she was not professionally trained per se, but she was essentially like a duck to water when it came to music. I mean, there was nothing she couldn't learn how to play. I mean, she did piano, guitar, stand-up, bass. Even I even smiled when she bought her own baton to conduct the orchestra. I thought, that woman's got some guts. She has confidence. She's got courage. But she was battling a lot of demons at the same time.
Well, she had perfect pitch. I don't know if I mentioned that, but she was gifted with that at birth. So that was something, you know, she had a great ear. She went from watching her husband at the time chart out and orchestrate her first album to teaching herself how to do that, writing out all the charts. You'll see some of them in the film, to her second album, the strings, the horns, an oboe, and conducting the orchestra that was playing them for her second album. So, I mean, this is not typical of a pop songwriter of any era, really. So she, musical genius is thrown around a lot, but I think you could make the case, in her case, that she was, as Linda Ronstadt says, there was no one had the same chops as she did, other than Brian Wilson. It's hard to disagree.
Very hard to disagree. I mean, when I watched this film, I knew there were, the ending was not going to be a happy one. And I got to thinking, what would it be like now if she was still with us? Didn't have to deal with, the botched back surgeries and things of that sort. But to have that genius amongst us right now. But I also noticed that Judy seemed to be having a problem learning how the music industry works. Or did she feel that she could succeed just doing what she wanted? I mean, hit songs back in the 70s made life super easy for an artist. Did she actually understand that?
Well, I don't think she knew how to constitutionally how to play the game. J.D. Souther in the film says she had sharp elbows, and she also was just, there was no BS about her. So she, didn't necessarily, she rubbed people the wrong way sometimes. As we all know, I mean, if you know her story at all, it alienated David Geffen to some degree. We don't know how much, but it definitely seemed to have to some degree. And in her mind, it contributed to derailing her career. I think she was aware of this tendency in her, but she just, she was a truth teller and was as harsh on herself as to anyone else.
That she was, she felt she was put here to save people through music, and that, she was receiving the music, from the heavens, and she was not willing to compromise.
I noticed that, especially with the clip within the film where the producer would say, when she's in the studio and you're trying to produce a record, you're basically not doing anything because she's doing everything. And it was basically in her mind, her way or the highway, because it was her songs and her creativity that she felt is going to make this amazing record. She also battled the fact that all of her label mates all had hit songs. And I think that she knew in her own heart that her songs were just as good. The public wasn't feeling it at that time, even though her songs were far ahead of their time. But I was wondering, and maybe a bit surprised, that the record executives didn't really step in and explain to her how the music industry works, maybe even supplying songwriters whose jobs are literally to write hit songs and for her to sing.
I think she considered trying to write hit songs. And in her journals later on, there are attempts to do that. At that point, though, she had lost label support. I think, as somebody, a friend of hers who's not in the film, had said to me, that it was so hard for her the first time going from kicking heroin in prison and telling herself if she could do that, she could do anything, and she wanted to be a singer-songwriter, to 4 years later being on the cover of Rolling Stone. And that was so hard that the idea of doing that again after she had lost the label support and had the back surgeries and all that was just overwhelmingly difficult. And she was in a lot of physical pain as well. But in the journals, there were attempts. It said, write a song for Linda, meaning Ron said, write a song for Emmy Lou. You know, I think she wanted to do that. But by that point, you know, things had taken a difficult turn for her.
Yeah, I was wondering, because after the second album and then when she got dropped, I was wondering, were there any other labels in the industry that wanted to pick her up? Or was it just stories behind the scenes of possibly her drug use and the possible story about her bad-mouthing David Geffen?
Well, they made a concerted effort with Dreams Come True, the last album she recorded, to find a label. And as you see in the film, you know, there were just no takers. And as Clive Davis kind of famously said, you know, it's a nice enough record, but it's lacking a commercial edge, you know.
And, yeah,
that's no different than what she faced for her first two albums, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, and the very statement that Clive made is no different than what other record executives have made on many other artists. I mean, you know, I've heard artists say, you know, we've submitted, you know, songs to 30 labels, been turned down, and then you finally get that one label goes, yeah, we'll take a chance. And then they end up selling millions of records. But I understand where Clive is coming from, because in the 1970s, it was all about commercial appeal. It was about getting on the radio, people singing your songs and buying your music. And it just didn't really hit hard enough for the record label as well as for Judy.
Mm-hmm. To be worth an investment into an artist that was, you know, necessary at that time.
It's true.
And I think she really just, it was also just so, she was facing all these other problems that just combined to make the effort just overwhelming. But she never gave up. She kept writing songs up until 3 days before she died, we found songs. She didn't want to die. She was terrified of dying of an OD. She says, you know, if you die of an OD, you'll be in limbo for 100 years. And the worst part of that is you'll be bored. But she believed it. She believed it. And so, but she had a disease. She had the disease of addiction, and that was stronger, sadly, you know.
Well, I have to ask, because one of the elements of the documentary that I really loved were all of the writings that were shown and some of the writings that were animated. Was that actual Judy's work and handwriting?
Yep. Yep. It all came from her journals. Yep.
What was it like looking at her personal journals?
It was devastating. And at the same time, uplifting too, just like Judy.
And it allowed us, because we found a tape recording of an interview Judy gave with a journalist named Chris Van Ness, an hour long interview where she told her life story up until around 1972, right before her first album was coming out. And so we wanted to tell the story in Judy's voice. That allowed us to do that. And the journals cover 73 to the end of her life, so we could construct a voiceover out of her written diary entries that an voice actress reads. Also, though, she was a very talented artist, so there's drawings. And that became the basis of the animation style. So it's almost like Judy's animating the animation, you know, is the animator of the film. And then lastly, we got the multi-tracks for Heart Food and Dreams Come True, so we could use those to score the film as if Judy were scoring the film. We really wanted to make a film that Judy herself would like. So that was a big goal of ours. So the journals were crucial in providing both voiceover and animation inspiration.
Well, for both of you, because you're co-directors on this film, which part did each of you co-direct?
Well, I think the beauty of it is all of it. You know, it was a complete collaboration, and I would include our editor, Mike Ward, in that, and also our producer, Peter Kenny. And what I loved about this project was it was just, it didn't matter whose idea it was, whatever was the best idea carried the day. And there's a real energy and kind of generosity of spirit in working that way. And I also think it allowed us to kind of honor Judy in the best way possible.
Yeah, and I think it's you know, you have to respect each other's opinions. So you try everything, even if you don't think it's a good idea. I mean, so many times I was wrong about something I didn't think was a good idea. And when you see it, it was. And one of the reasons it took us nearly 10 years to make the film is that we had to try all these ideas. We had to just do everything. So we worked on Zoom during COVID, but then I would fly to Portland and work with Brian and Mike, the editor, and intensively in a room, which you really do need to do. And we just tried everything. Well, so it sounds kind of tedious, but it wasn't. It was exhilarating, really.
Because it's a sense of discovery, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know what makes this film very, very special? And I've seen so many music film documentaries, but this one is different because the way that y'all put it together is very artistic. What I loved is that when you watch it, yes, there's parts when you're hearing the other people tell stories and their interactions with Judy. But when you have the voiceover, you're seeing the journal notes, it's almost like you're watching an autobiography on video, where all the others that you watch are like biographies. But this one, it's almost like, it's like you literally brought Judy back to life.
Well, you just made my day.
We really wanted to make an immersive film, you know, that made people feel like they were with Judy. And it's so gratifying to hear you say that word. Thank you.
Well, for me, as I was watching, I'm like, man, I would have really liked to meet her or to have a conversation with her. But I also felt deep sadness for her because one instant she is full of joy, and in the next moment it is absolutely pain and despair. And when she's like, God, you know, I know you got a plan for me. And then the one next moment is like, where are you? You know, can you hear me? Do you know that I'm here? And it's just like, oh my gosh. I mean, it's like, you know, I've heard these stories from other people, but the way you put this together, the audience is going to feel her emotions. They're going to feel and live what she's feeling and what is, how her heart is beating. That's why this film is so amazing. And this film should be winning an award one right after the other. It's that good. So kudos to both of you on this incredible film. But I have to ask, because there's one section of this film that I replayed because I got to thinking about it. And when the story came up about Judy bad-mouthing David Geffen, and I was like, boy, to say something like that back in the 1970s, you got to have a lot of guts, or somebody really ticked you off, or you're so frustrated. I mean, deeply frustrated with your career. It just came out. I went back again to watch David's demeanor. So when I watched his response to y'all's question of what Judy had said, he doesn't blink. He seemed very stoic, very protective. his overall demeanor is really left open to interpretation. Your thoughts?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think we just leave that for the audience to decide exactly what happened. I will tell you that it was really interesting interviewing David. And, you know, you never hear people talk about David's sensitive side. But after the interview was over, he came up to me and looked me right in the eye and said, please make sure you get my relationship with Judy right, because she was very important to me. And I promised him we would, you know, do our best. And I hope we did him justice.
I think you did. And I think when the audience watches it, David quietly holds a special place for Judy. I don't think he was happy in the way that it ended, because in the 1970s, you know, record labels developed artists. They don't do that today. And I feel that he wishes he had more time with Judy, but just with certain circumstances that we may all never know, just prevented that from happening. But do you feel that the only person standing in Judy's way to success was Judy herself?
Well, I think you have to consider that as a big factor. I do think there probably is some truth to Asylum maybe pulling back a little publicity after that happened and David's not remembering it or whatever. But as you might hear in the film, I think it was so painful to her that her second album, Heartbeat, this beautiful album, sold less than her first album. And in some ways, it might have been easier to blame Geffen and what she had done and how she had blown it to the weak sales. I mean, that was the cause of her losing her label support and not the fact that the sales were poor. And one other thing I'll point out is that in the journals, like I said, it covers from 73 on, there's not a single mention of David Geffen. That says something, I guess. But she did tell all her friends that she said something and she blew it. She knew it and she felt bad about it. So I have no doubt that she knew that she had done something that she had gotten in her own way.
I would have never dropped her from the label if it was due to just the outburst. It's a human reaction. It's frustration of seeing all of your label mates have these huge number one hit songs, great albums, and then you're not doing so well. And if an outburst happens, look, it's a human reaction. And for a lot of people, sometimes you just got to let it go and don't play it out in the, you know, today they would just play it out in the media and let the public decide who's right and who's wrong and who should get fired or who should get hung. I mean, that's the world we live in. But for Judy or any artist, yeah, I probably would have given her far more time, but I understand that there's investments. One of the other things that I loved about this film was Judy's spirituality. Where did that come from?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think it came from her family. I don't know that there was a religious background there. You know,
I think it came from a desperate search for relief of psychic pain and a belief that she was channeling some higher power to create her music, that it was about math. It was about, and math is perfect and perfection comes from God. And so that's must be the source. And she really believed that. And she continued a spiritual quest to the end. So that was genuine.
She did. And one of the people that you had in the documentary, a young woman, and I think she mentioned it twice, where Judy looked at the spirituality of God, but also it was intertwined with sensuality. And I thought, well, just read the Book of Solomon or the Songs of Solomon in the Bible. That's exactly what that is. That's sensuality and the Lord being meshed together, so to speak. So Judy's thought process and her spirituality ran extremely deep. That was another reason why her songs are so far ahead of their time. I was telling Brian before the interview, even right now, if you go on Spotify and you listen to Judy Seal's songs, you're like, this stuff would sell today. So I think she missed her calling by 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's obviously sad and bittersweet that she can't enjoy this, but she'd be delighted.
Yeah. And the very things that perhaps prevented her music from reaching that wide audience when she was alive are the exact same things that are attracting this bigger audience now that she's dead.
Indeed. Well, where can everyone see this film?
Well, it starts streaming on April 12th on Apple and Amazon, and we're opening in New York at the IFC Center in New York City on the 12th, or the 11th, and then on the 12th in L.A. at, what theater is that, Brian?
The Lamalee NoHo 7.
Yeah. And then at some select theaters around the country, you can find out, the best place is Instagram or Facebook. On Instagram, it's Judy Sill Doc. On Facebook, it's Los Angeles, The Genius of Judy Sill. That's where you can find out more.
You can also go to Greenwich Entertainment's website, and the film has a website there.
Ah, great. And ladies and gentlemen, if you love music history, then you need to make your way to the theater and see The Lost Angel, The Genius. And I mean the emphasis on genius of Judy Sill. The never-before-told story of folk rock icon Judy Sill, who in just 2 years went from living in a car to appearing on the cover of Rolling Stone. And the documentary charts her troubled adolescence through her meteoric rise in the music world and her early tragic death. The film features Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Browne, even David Crosby, Graham Nash, even David Geffen, and so many more. Andy, Brian, I have to tell you one thing. You put out a film that is like no other. It has a personal touch. It's emotional for a music film documentary. And like I said, I don't think any film documentary has ever been created that has the very essence of feeling like an autobiography of someone that is no longer with us. You're both brilliant and a stellar job.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a million.
You're very welcome. And again, ladies and gentlemen, we all love Instagram, so head over to Judy Sill Doc, D-O-C, and you'll be able to find all of the theaters. And again, it's streaming April 12th, beginning on Apple TV and Prime, so get ready for that. Hey, I would rather see this film in the big theater to get the full sound and just to get the full emotion of who Judy Sill was. And of course, get on Spotify, listen to her incredible songs, and you're going to understand, just like Andy, Brian, even myself, her songs are far, far ahead of their time. And, well, we can just praise the Lord that we have Judy Sill's music still with us so that we can have our time and just sit back with a set pair of headphones on and soak in her masterful songwriting, her voice, and her incredible musical talent. And ladies and gentlemen, you can catch all of the replays of our interviews with the top film directors, producers, screenwriters, and actors, and so much more at Bond on Cinema. We're also available on YouTube as well as a dozen audio platforms as well. So I want to thank you for watching and listening. And as for me, I'll either see you at the movies or from the red carpet.
There are quite a few stories about your background.
Okay. Would you like some of the wilder ones?
Geffen said, you gotta go see this girl, Judy Sill. I said, what's she like? And he said, she's like nobody else.
She was the first artist signed to Asylum Records, and Geffen had tremendous belief in her.
He said, what do you want to do? And I said, I wanted to be the greatest living songwriter in the world.
I heard the song, and it was very intriguing because I thought it could be a hit.
We like each other's songs. You know, like I love Jackson's songs that he wrote, and I love JD's songs, but everybody seemed to think that Judy had something special.
When I met her, she told me she was a heroin addict, that she'd been a prostitute, and that she'd been in jail. So that's a lot of information.
She had pointed the gun at the guy and said, okay, mother sticker, this is a fuck up.
I knew that I had to clean up or else go back to jail. So I got a tattoo in my arm to remind me forever. And then I started formulating exactly what my mission would be.
This is The Kiss by Judy Sill.
I had never heard a song about that. It just felt like a bottomless well.
Love rising from the mist,
like a level of desperation and vulnerability that totally transcends a lot of the real personal songwriting that was going on at the time.
There just wasn't and won't be anybody that writes like that. I've never heard anything that's made me go, oh, that sounds like Judy Sill.
I want to inspire people and uplift them without them knowing it. That's what I want to do.